It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat?
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations. Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
Oh, man, what a World Series. Back-to-back championships for the Dodgers. See, that's what's supposed to happen when you spend $320 million on your payroll. You're supposed to win titles. Second biggest payroll in all of Major League Baseball. Second only to the Mets, who ended up on the couch at home watching the World Series just like the rest of us. I wish I was able to see more of it live. I couldn't because of all the streams, but I got to catch the tail end of the game last night, Game 7. One of the craziest games you'll ever see. I will say it pained me to see Yamamoto out there as the MVP, knowing the Mets made a play for him and he turned us down. But I would say he made the right decision. This is episode 936 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 2nd, 2025. Now on day number 3 of having all of the Disney networks pulled off of YouTube TV. Don't you just love it? No warning, no heads up. I get an email at 11:30 at night on Thursday that I no longer have access to ABC, ESPN, or FX Network. And any library recordings from those channels have been deleted. Yet another carriage dispute. I already didn't have free access to the new ESPN app, even though I have ESPN, or I had ESPN, because they never worked out a deal with YouTube TV. Now I don't have ESPN at all. Now they're fighting with Disney. I feel like I get one of these emails every few weeks. Like, they're always fighting with someone. So I went back and I checked. September 30th, I got an email from them telling me that I was losing Televisa/Univision, which, I mean, you know how big a fan I am of Univision. I mean, I have it on in the background all day, every day while I'm working. You would think that my Spanish would be better by now. 4 days before that, I got an email from them warning that I might soon lose all of the NBC Universal channels, which would have affected my WWE viewing. NBC and Google, they ended up working it out. The month before that, I got an email from them announcing that I might be losing all of the Fox networks. And a few days later, they worked it all out. And then earlier in the year, it was the Paramount networks. They said I was about to lose all of those, which would have included CBS. Like, these people have had more fights in the last few years than Conor McGregor. Thankfully, I can get my Shark Tank fix from Hulu, but you know, if you're big into sports, especially college football, you're probably not going to be a YouTube TV customer for very much longer if they don't get their shit together. I mean, people are going to take their business elsewhere. You don't mess with someone's football. Even I know that. I mean, they keep pulling channels left and right, yet the cost keeps going up. I may have to look elsewhere too, which sucks because I actually like the service otherwise. Anyway, thank you guys for a great Halloween stream the other night. A great way to close out the month of October. I may have to bring out the Macho Monster every year. He was a big hit. Today, I've got Saturday night's main event fallout to get into from last night's show. We have a new world heavyweight champion, and we have news on how WWE intends to decide John Cena's final opponent. And I've got the teams for the men's and women's blood and guts matches in AEW. And I've got news on Vince Russo's return to pro wrestling. Yes, this is not The Onion. This is not kayfabe news. This is a very real thing. If you would like to make a PayPal donation to support the show, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out as part of our roll call here on this show. And I want to say up front here to PB, thank you for your generosity, as always. I agree with your message. I feel your frustration. I've got open enrollment starting in a few weeks, and I'm dreading how much more I'm going to have to pay just to see my doctor. It's awful. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. I hope you had a very happy Halloween, Paul. Big B, Bryant Becerra. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. Fast Blast, Tim Banks. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Killshot, Keith Hart, tough guy, Temujin Zephyr. And we had Temujin, Paul too, but we had Temujin dropping a bomb the other night. Recon Russell Bulware says, keep up the good work. Wrestling has been literally unwatchable 90% of the time for nearly 15 years, but you have been a bright spot. I've been around for a while, making me feel old. The Georgia Nightmare, Timothy Tillis, who is celebrating his 26th birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday, Timothy. Molly from Toronto, happy 37th birthday. I hope it was a great one. On Halloween, no less. A Halloween baby. And David from Chicago also turned 34 years old this week. Happy birthday to all of you. I hope you got to enjoy it however you spent it. House of Glory is collaborating with the Big Event Expo in New York on Saturday, November 15th to bring you
Super Clash.
Super Clash at the Suffolk Credit Union Arena. Our first trip to Strong Island, and just announced the AEW TBS champion, 12 belts Monet, Mercedes Monet makes her return to House of Glory. Now we just need her to make it out of that blood and guts match in one piece, since that's 3 days before our show. That's in addition to some of the other big names on the card, including Nick Nemeth and Killer Cross. We've got that Shayna Baszler, Maki Ito match that I'm actually very much looking forward to being on the call for. And also just announced, and this one has been in the works for a while, and we just closed the deal last week, HOG is coming to the City of Angels for the first time ever, Los Angeles, California, at the historic Globe Theater, which is a legendary venue in downtown LA, opened in 1913. It's been remodeled over the years. It closed last year, but now it's back. And House of Glory, at least as far as wrestling goes, is the first one back in. And we are very excited about that. I don't know that I will be there because it's Friday, January 30th, which is the day before the Royal Rumble, the Saudi Rumble, which is airing earlier in the day, the very next day. But regardless, that is a show that you are not going to want to miss. Tickets for both those events and our Chicago show are now on sale at hogwrestling.net. Last I checked, there were legitimately 5 tickets left for the Chicago show, and those LA tickets are flying. So don't wait too long. Front Row is already sold out. We learned earlier in the week that WWE Hall of Famer Mike Rotunda, the father of Bray Wyatt and Bo Dallas, and who, for all the things he's done in his career, is probably best known, not even probably, he's best known for playing an evil IRS agent. We were told that Rotunda was in hospice care, which is never a good sign, and it was shocking because it came completely out of left field from his brother-in-law, former tag team partner Barry Windham. He's the one who shared that bit of information with Bill Apter. The interview was conducted on October 25th. He did not disclose what the health issue was that he was suffering from, only that he was in hospice care. And, you know, for those who don't know, hospice is recommended when someone typically has exhausted all other treatment options or has foregone them and is nearing the end of their life. So it's really about palliative care at that point and just making you feel as comfortable as possible. My mother was in hospice care for all of 4 days before she passed away. But then on Wednesday, Mika Rotunda, Mike's daughter, Bray and Bo's sister, issued the following statement clarifying that her dad is not in hospice care, but rather he is in a rehab center after suffering a massive heart attack. She said, "Our family would like to take a moment to clarify some information currently circulating online regarding my father, Mike Rotunda. Yes, my Uncle Barry did make a comment mentioning that my father is in hospice care while answering a question about my late brother, Wyndham, whom we lost 2 years ago. My father is not in hospice, but rather in a rehabilitation center. He suffered a massive heart attack on September 20th, was in a coma for a week, and spent over a month hospitalized. By the grace of God, he is now transitioned into a rehab center where our family remains present, hopeful, and focused on his recovery. It has already been a long road, and we know there is still a long road ahead, but our faith in God remains strong. Anyone who knows my dad knows that it's his strength, work ethic, and athleticism that have carried him through not just this, but every challenge life has thrown his way. If there's one person I have faith in, it's Captain Mike. We are deeply grateful for the outpouring of love, prayers, and support from the wrestling world and our local communities. At this time, we kindly ask for privacy as we continue walking this journey together, but we warmly welcome continued prayers and healing thoughts for his recovery. So that would explain why Bo Dallas has been absent from television recently. He has not appeared in any of the Wyatt Six segments, and there haven't been that many of them, but the ones that there have been, he has been absent from those segments. They just posted a YouTube video, actually, showing all the members, minus Bo, going through the Wyatt Six haunted house in Orlando as part of their Halloween Horror Nights. And I think the last night for it actually is tonight. And it was heartbreaking seeing Eric Rowan get so broken up about Bray and Brody. You know, he's the last one left of the original Wyatt family. So especially when they went through the swamp room, I think he called it, they had a camera following them. It's like a vlog. And so they had a camera following them, and multiple times in the video, Rowan just breaks down. Like, you could just see the hurt in his eyes and just how hurt he is still about losing his brothers. Because that's what they were to him. I mean, they weren't just people that he worked with. You know, they were brothers. And they should both be here right now, and they're not. And it sucks. So it was heartbreaking seeing him like that. But in any event, Bo has not been around. Now we know why. And Mike is not in hospice, which is great, but it sounds like it'll be a long road ahead for him. I saw people giving the wrestling news websites a lot of shit for not fact-checking. And, you know, normally I would agree. A lot of them will just post shit without verifying it first. There are certain people, you know, some of the more reputable sites, whether it be Fightful, whether it be PW Insider, even WrestleVotes, you know, when they post stuff. But then you have some of these other websites, they'll just, and the Facebook pages, these random wrestling Facebook pages, they're the worst. They are the absolute dirt worst, some of them. Like, I see some of these posts that come up in my feed, or somebody will send me a screenshot, and you would think, like, it's some sort of tease for a wrestler, something happened to them, and it's like, oh my God, you know, tragic development here. And then you click on it, and the person got, like, you know, a fucking cold or something. Like, it's just awful. So there is a lot of misinformation that goes around on a weekly basis. I see it, you see it, it's a real thing. And, you know, there is not a lot of fact-checking going on a lot of times. But, to be fair, it was a member of the family who gave that update. It's not like it was some rumor that somebody started at random and just people ran with it. You know, Barry Windham himself is the one who said that Mike Rotunda was in hospice care. So, I mean, if you can't trust the family, then who can you trust? So he either misspoke or he was misinformed. But he and Mike were inducted into the Hall of Fame together last year as the U.S. Express. They won a couple of tag team titles together there, wrestled at the first WrestleMania. Mike went on to win three more tag team titles in WWE as part of Money Incorporated with Ted DiBiase. And the IRS gimmick, you know, it was a product of its time. It was very goofy. Yeah, but he got good heat for it. Vince McMahon hated the IRS. So we got IRS. Just like we got the right to censor. Years later with Stevie Richards, right? That was born out of their fight with the Parents Television Council. It makes you wonder what other ridiculous gimmicks we had to suffer through on TV that actually came from real-life people that Vince McMahon did not like. But Rotunda spent a lot of time in Crockett Promotions and WCW also, so, I mean, he had himself a nice career. And, you know, Bo went through enough losing his brother. I'm sure he's scared to death about losing his dad also, so he'll take whatever time he needs and be back when he's ready to be back. Hopefully all works out with Mike and he can eventually make a full recovery. WWE held its penultimate edition of Saturday Night's Main Event last night in Salt Lake City, a show that was carried largely by good matches, nothing great, with a very underwhelming main event and a major announcement regarding John Cena's final opponent, and that is where I will begin. John Cena was not there in Utah, but they aired a clip from a sit-down interview that he did with Fox Sports reporter Tom Rinaldi, where he reiterated that after, and he's been very adamant about this, he reiterated that after next month, we will never see him back in the ring wrestling ever again. None of these fake-ass wrestling retirements. He means what he says. December 13th in DC will be your last chance to ever see John Cena sporting the jorts in a wrestling ring. And then in a separate video package, Cena said that he's never been one to pick his opponents, and this time will not be any different. He believes the opportunity to wrestle him in his final match should not be given, it should be hard-earned. And so starting a week from Monday, live on Raw in his hometown of Boston, WWE will kick off what they are calling the Last Time Is Now tournament with a 16-man bracket to decide on his final opponent. And he said that it will include stars from Raw, from SmackDown, from NXT, and even some faces that don't work there from other places. So Meltzer's report of a tournament a few weeks ago was accurate. There was never any chance of them doing a tournament for the World Heavyweight title if this was the plan all along. No way they were going to run two different tournaments like this at the same time on TV, especially since there would, I'm sure, be overlap with some of the names in both tournaments. You just can't do that. It's too bad, but I understand it. As far as this idea, though, I love this idea. This is a coveted spot. It should be treated as such, right? To be able to say that you were the last person to ever step foot in the ring with someone who WWE routinely refers to as the greatest of all time. Everybody should want to be in that spot. And it's a great way to inject some life into these weekly shows, especially on Fridays. They could use it. I like that. I like that it is cross-branded. I don't see why it wouldn't be. I like that NXT is included, because that opens it up to people like Obafemi, Ricky Saints, Javon Evans, right, to be a part of this. And apparently, even Brooks Jensen. I have no interest in seeing Brooks Jensen hogging up a spot in this thing, but he has got an axe to grind with John Cena. He tweeted, "It's been 22 years since John Cena screwed my father's career over. Maybe my time is now." So if you don't know what this is in reference to, Brooks Jensen is the son of former WWE star Bull Buchanan. Bull Buchanan got a big character makeover after his days in the Truth Commission and then the Right to Censor. They sent him back, I think, to Ohio Valley for a while, and they repackaged him as John Cena's hype man when Cena was first starting his Doctor of Thugonomics gimmick. And Cena started calling him B-squared, and he would always yell, "Booyah!" At the end of that, like fucking Shane McMahon, at the end of every Cena freestyle, Cena would finish and he would give him the mic and go, "Booyah!" Right? That was his gimmick. And so I remember they brought him back, actually, on Raw. God, what year was this? They did a John Cena This Is Your Life segment with Mick Foley as the host. And they brought back Bull Buchanan, who went off on how he got fired, then his wife left him, and then he got rabies from a dog bite or something. I don't know, some nonsense. And he blamed Cena. He said John Cena ruined his life. So now I guess his son is taking up for dear old dad and looking for revenge. I think that pairing lasted like 2 months. They weren't together for very long. But yeah, I would say that of the 16 spots in this thing, we can do without wasting one on B-squared Jr. But the faces from other places, that makes this a lot more interesting. And obviously, people are immediately going to think of Adam Copeland. We are not getting another Cena Edge match, okay? I said this last night. There was talk that Copeland's contract with AEW may have expired in October. Again, I don't know where that started. I actually think it's next October that his contract might be up. But unless his deal very quietly expired, and it's hard to keep secrets like that in wrestling, okay? That would be a hell of a thing if that man's contract expired and nobody said anything about it. Tony Khan has already been, he's been asked about Copeland. He's already said he's out filming and he's looking forward to having him back on TV. Edge is not going to be in this tournament, right? We all know the wrestlers all get along between WWE and AEW. It's not a wrestler issue, okay? We know about the tribalism among the fan bases. I mean, that's about as toxic as it gets and pathetic and just ridiculous. So the wrestlers, they all get along. Well, I mean, all but Punk and the Elite, I guess. But the other wrestlers, they get along fine. But do you not understand the hatred that exists between the people who run these two companies? Like, and WWE constantly counter-programming AEW. Yeah, fucking Andrade showing up on Dynamite and then immediately disappearing when WWE reminded him about the non-compete that he has. Fucking Lex Luger said he wanted Sting to induct him into the Hall of Fame this year. I don't know if there were ever any real efforts to make that happen, but he was pretty public about it. And they couldn't even work something out to allow Sting, who was already retired. I mean, I get he may still be under some sort of AEW deal, but he's retired. and they couldn't work something out to allow him to induct one of his best friends into the Hall of Fame? Like, these are not two companies that get along well. Do you honestly believe that Tony Khan would allow WWE to use Adam Copeland and have him lose, no less? Like, I cannot imagine those conversations are happening. You are setting yourself up for some massive disappointment if you are waiting to see him back for this tournament. Now, they're talking about TNA. That's what they're talking about when they say, oh, people from other places who don't work here. And they've got plenty of people to choose from there, like Nick Nemeth, Matt Cardona, Mike Santana, Jeff Hardy. Can you believe John Cena and Jeff Hardy only had one match together? It was a random Raw match like 17 years ago. Joe Hendry. Joe Hendry has been lobbying for a match with John Cena all year. Of course he's going to be in this tournament. And that's to say nothing of all the names that are on the main roster, right? Sheamus should get a spot in there. He's got history with Cena. I could see Miz and Carmelo Hayes having their match in the tournament because we know they're going to have a match soon. Ilya Dragunov. He's been killing it since he came back. He has inherited the U.S. title open challenge that was born out of John Cena's championship run 10 years ago. He's been the one bright spot on SmackDown every week since he came back. But at the end of the day, this is a vehicle for the return of Gunther. Gunther already retired one guy this year, some white guy. I don't know. I think it's pronounced the Goldberg. And now he's going to retire John Cena. This tournament is his to lose. I would love to see a Gunther-Dragunov final. The Mad Dragon and the Ring General. I would think the finals would be held at Survivor Series because Saturday night's main event is only 2 weeks later. A Gunther-Dragunov final in San Diego? Please and thank you. Today's episode is sponsored by Hims. Guys, what's one of the most important traits that women look for in a man? Confidence. A lot of confidence can go a long way. That's probably true of a lot of things in life, not just love, but even in business. So it's not surprising that how much hair you have on your head can directly correlate to how confident you are. That's why hair loss isn't just about what's on your head. It's how you feel when you see that person looking back at you in the mirror. That's where Hims can be a game changer for you. Hims helps you take back that confidence with access to simple, personalized care that fits your life and your goals. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays. Doctor-trusted, clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. You shouldn't have to go out of your way just to feel like yourself. That's ridiculous. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. There's no hidden fees, there's no surprise costs, just real personalized care on your schedule. You can think of Hims as your digital front door that you walk through to get back to your old self. With simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for real health concerns, all in one place. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/solomonster. That's hims.com/solomonster for your free online visit. hims.com/solomonster. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. As for the rest of the show, we have two new champions. CM Punk is the new World Heavyweight Champion, and Jade Cargill is the new WWE Women's Champion. And with Cody Rhodes as the WWE Champion, Ricky Saints as the NXT Champion, Ethan Page as the Men's North American Champion, and Blake Monroe as the Women's North American Champion, you might say that's a pretty elite group of title holders they have right now. This was the most enjoyable Saturday night's main event yet for this reason, and I'm not even talking about the quality of the show. No commercials during the actual matches, because they're not on NBC anymore. It's Peacock only here in the States. We got 10 minutes worth of commercials in between the matches, which is why we only had four of them on the entire show. But I can live with that. So long as they're not disruptive to the actual matches, I'm fine with that, right? I mean, they got to pay the bills. I get it. Gives me time to finish my notes after each match, between the ads and the 15-minute entrances when they come back. I got plenty of time. So at least we don't have to worry about John Cena's final match being sliced up the way that his SmackDown match was against Sami Zayn. Also, this was the first Saturday night's main event without Jesse Ventura. So he appears to be gone, all because he spoke his mind and he told the truth about that dumb finish in the cage match with Damian Priest and Drew McIntyre. They have not had him back on commentary since. He did some hosting, and now they don't even have him doing that, unless he wasn't there because Joe Tessitore wasn't going to be there. You know, Joe Tessitore is usually in the Mean Gene role as the host. Then they script out a bunch of shit for Jesse to say as his sidekick. Tessitore had college football commitments this weekend, as I'm sure he will probably the entire season here. So he was not there. But believe me, if they wanted Jesse back, he would have been there. They would have found some other role for him, or they would have had someone stand in for Joe Tess. I guess Jesse was a little too honest for them. Now, they opened the show with Cody Rhodes and Drew McIntyre for the WWE Championship. And on SmackDown Friday night, they had their contract signing. And they added a few stipulations to try to make things a little more interesting. And those stipulations were that if Cody Rhodes were to be disqualified or were to be counted out, he would lose the WWE Championship. And what we ended up with here, they basically had the same match they had at WrestlePalooza, right down to the lousy finish. This match may have been slightly better. So it was a good match, and then just a very underwhelming finish. McIntyre was constantly trying to goad Cody into a countout or goad him into being disqualified. Cody would not take the bait. And it came down to the title belt being introduced into the ring by McIntyre, and we got a referee bump. This referee, by the way, he was lightly squashed in the corner. But you would think that he got sniped by somebody camping in the rafters. Like, it was just completely preposterous. And Cody ended up delivering a DDT onto the belt. And then he ditched the evidence, and he finished off McIntyre with one crossroads, and he retained the title. Even without the champion's advantage, Cody retains anyway, just as he did at WrestlePalooza. And in that match, if you remember, Drew put his own foot through the announce desk, and he hurt his foot, which led to him losing. But he would go on to blame the referee for it because the referee tried to stop him from doing so. Right before he was going to deliver that kick, remember the referee dove out of the ring and said, no, 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 even though there was nothing illegal about him doing that, right? That was his gripe coming out of the match. And here his new gripe is going to be that he got DDT'd onto the belt, which should have been a disqualification. He should be the champion right now, even though he's the one who introduced the belt into the ring in the first place. But in both cases, let's just be honest, he got beat. He got beat clean. As with his King of the Ring win, Cody's King of the Ring win over Randy Orton, Cody Rhodes, he merely capitalized off of the circumstances that were presented to him to keep his title. Right? In that match, it was Orton messing around, I think, with the turnbuckle pad. This does seem to be a recurring theme I'm noticing now with Cody, doesn't it? Right? Cody taking advantage of other people's mistakes and having no problem in doing so. It seems that he has learned from his WrestleMania mistake against John Cena. I love it. I love it when a dumb babyface finds the cure. It's a terrible disease, but it can be cured. I was half expecting to see all the tweets on X, vaxxed. Was Cody vaxxed? Since that's what I see on there all the time anyway. You can't fucking sneeze without some idiot asking vaxxed. A local man was killed today when an 18-wheeler slammed into his VW bug. The car then burst into flames, scattering ash across a 5-mile radius. Yes, but was he vaxxed? These are the pressing questions that need to be answered. I have some questions of my own for these people. Namely, how many times did your mother fuck her brother? Or as you call him, dad. But Cody is cured. And Drew McIntyre, he has shifted into that territory with Kevin Owens and LA Knight, where they simply cannot win the big one. I know Drew won the big one 5 years ago in front of no fans, but he has been out in the desert ever since. And you just get to a point where even if they run this back again at Survivor Series, and they very well might, maybe with Randy Orton thrown in as well if he ever comes back to work, even if Drew finally wins at Survivor Series, will anyone care? Like, that's the question. Will anyone even care? Like, originally, from what we have been told, this match was going to take place at Survivor Series. And the only reason it didn't was because they were going to run back a Drew McIntyre-Jacob Fatu match last night on Saturday night's main event. I presume McIntyre would have won and would have gone on to Survivor Series, right? Maybe not. But let's assume that was the case. Like, is that the finish that they would have given us in San Diego? You know how awful that would have been? To drag this thing out for another month and give us the same dog shit finish they gave us last night? Like, again, if Drew finally wins the championship, is anybody going to care? Like, how many times can you say that you're going to do something and consistently fail before people stop giving a shit? Like, what else is left for these two to even talk about on TV? How many times are they going to say the same thing over and over again to build to another match? They have to bring Randy back for that reason alone if they intend to run this thing back, because I don't know how many more of the same promo I can tolerate between these two, between now and Survivor Series, right? They've talked about their parallel paths in their careers, and Cody says, we should be, owe you a debt of gratitude, and, you know, you left, and you got fired, and you came back, and, you know, McIntyre talks about Cody being a fraud, and I'm a good person, and you're not. It's like, okay, that was fine for this match, but what are you going to do for the next 4 weeks? Jade Cargill, she is the new WWE Women's Champion, won the title from Tiffany Stratton in less than 5 minutes, or maybe it was around 5 minutes. This was, I said this last night, this was the female equivalent of Brock Lesnar against John Cena at WrestlePalooza, where Cena got a little bit of offense in. It wasn't a total 100% squash. It was only a 95% squash. And Jade took most of the match, and she looked dominant, and she just beat Tiffany straight up in the middle of the ring and won the championship and just looked like an absolute monster in doing so. Just destroyed this woman in a way that we have not seen Tiffany treated at all this year, where she spent most of the year undefeated. So they gave Tiffany some hope spots, but this was a match that played to Jade's strengths, which is those big power moves and keeping the match fairly limited. Again, they went 5 minutes. It wasn't a long, drawn-out thing. She didn't have to go in there and sell and do all sorts of stuff like that. Jade is the one who just got turned heel. Tiffany is the one who they gave the out to in this match because her knee was all wrapped up from the attack the other week. She had the bad knee, and they used that as a way to protect her as much as they could. So she's not hurt by the loss. Even though I think that, I'm giving my soapbox here for a second, I think that they spend way too much time protecting people and not trusting enough in their own talent or their own booking ability to allow them to suffer clean losses more often. Not everyone needs to be protected at all times. Okay, Gunther is proof of that. Gunther has taken lots of clean losses to Cody Rhodes, CM Punk, Sami Zayn, fucking Jey Uso. It hasn't hurt him at all. He's about to retire John Cena. But it just feels like Bianca is waiting in the wings for Jade, and that's going to be your WrestleMania match. It's just a matter of when does Bianca come back? Supposedly she was there in Salt Lake City. I don't know if she was visiting or there for any particular reason to film stuff. I don't know. So she's around, but it's just a matter of when she's medically cleared. And when are they ready to bring her back? Now that Jade is the champion, who knows? Maybe they've been holding out Bianca and she's been secretly cleared, and they've been waiting for this moment to bring her back. I hope so. The quicker they can get her back on SmackDown, the better off that division is going to be. Speaking of titles, Dominic Mysterio, still a double champion. He is still the mega intercontinental champion with a win over Penta and Rusev in their triple threat match. I thought it was a fun match that never dragged. They kept things moving along at a nice pace. By default, it was the best thing on the entire show, you know, match-wise, and even this match here. I mean, it was a good match. It wasn't, like, great or anything like that. It's not going to be some memorable triple threat match when this year is over and we look back on some of the best matches on these PLEs and special shows that they've done. But it was the best thing on the show. I never bought into the idea of Dom losing the belt here. I don't know where they go from here with Penta and Rusev. They've had some, it's kind of like Drew, where, you know, they've had so many opportunities that you just get to a point where it's like, all right, it's time to move on to something else here. And if Meltzer is to be believed, and he was right about the tournament for John Cena, then he also mentioned that the plan for Survivor Series was to do a match between John Cena and Dominic Mysterio for the Intercontinental title, likely with Cena winning the championship and defending it in his final match next month against Gunther or whoever it's going to be. And I could do without that, but it is what it is. If that's the case, then we know what Dom's next direction is going to be. So what that means for Penta, I don't know. But then in the main event, we had CM Punk winning the World Heavyweight Championship. He went one-on-one with Jey Uso. This was not a match that I was at all excited for. Of all the potential options they could have gone with here, they went with the one that I thought was the most boring. But they put them in the main event, and the world championship's on the line, so at least there's something tangible here. And it's like, all right, I don't know that I've ever seen these two have a singles match before. Let's see how this goes. And as it was, this was easily one of the worst big CM Punk matches of the year. He's had some really good matches. I've seen Jey Uso have better matches. I think a lot of it comes down to who he's in the ring with. And with Punk, we know Punk can still have great matches, but, you know, it's 50-50 how it's going to go. Last night was not it. I did not like this main event. They had a bad match. And it started to really break down early in the match. There was a neckbreaker spot. And Punk was going for a simple neckbreaker here, and Jey looked like he just kept rotating as Punk was trying to turn him, and it just fell apart. And it just didn't look good. And there was another spot that came after this also with a spear attempt by Jey out of the corner that just didn't look right. But you could tell that Punk was miffed about the neckbreaker botch because he immediately gets up and he kicks Jey right in the fucking head. And then they redid the spot. And it reminded me of Vader not moving when he was supposed to at SummerSlam when Shawn Michaels came off the top rope. So Shawn just lands on his feet, and he just stomps him right in the head. Brett did that with Davey Boy in their Wembley match. Actually, Punk was part of that watch-along. They did a watch-along years ago. I forgot what YouTube channel it was on. They did a watch-along of the Bret Hart British Bulldog match, and Brett was there, and Punk was there. I think Booker T might have been part of it. And they talked about the spot where Brett had Davey in a sleeper hold. And he really wanted Davey to milk the sleeper before he got to the ropes. 30 seconds, a minute, you know, whatever it was. But like, build drama, right? Take your time. Slow down. And Davey just rushes over and grabs the rope. And he killed all the drama, and Brett was pissed. So Brett stood up, and he just kicked him square in the face. Hard. Maybe not like a full-on shot, but he kicked him hard enough to wake his ass up. And then they redid the spot. Maybe Punk had that on the brain since he was part of that watch along. But I was also thinking about this. Yeah, I mentioned when I was doing my review of the match last night, there was a moment where Punk gave Jey a go to sleep, right? One of the 18 times he gave him a go to sleep in this match. And Jey fell out of the ring, right? He didn't fall out of the ring like as a shoot. It was part of the spot, but he falls out of the ring. And Punk goes outside and he grabs a bottle of water. And he pours the water on Jey and then puts him back in the ring. And I thought, well, that was strange. Like, why would you do that? Maybe he was trying to wake his ass up because he didn't look like he was all there in the first half of this match. Now, they had a couple of good near falls near the end, but it ended up taking a good half a dozen go to sleeps in this match for Punk to finally put this man away and win the championship. So there was no vision. We didn't see any of the bronze. Jimmy Uso was there, but he never came out for the match. There was no big turn. There was no big, shocking twist or a cliffhanger ending or anything like that. They played it completely straight and basic, right down the middle, to keep the focus on this being CM Punk's big world championship win, right? He won the title at SummerSlam. He lost it 5 minutes later. Now he's going to get a proper run, however long it lasts. I don't know that it's going to WrestleMania, but however long it lasts, now he is a proper world heavyweight champion. So they wanted the focus to be squarely on that. And I was one of those people hoping that they had something else in mind here and we wouldn't actually get a winner. But again, the John Cena tournament stuff, it just, they weren't going to do a tournament. They were not going to drag this out any longer than they had to. So if somebody had to win, Punk was the right choice. If only to then have him, you know, put someone like Bron Breakker over strong when he does drop the belt. Jey Uso had his run. Let me say this about Jey Uso. Jey Uso had his run. Jey Uso should no longer be anywhere near the World Heavyweight Championship. The first half of this match was embarrassing. First half of this match was a sloppy mess. I don't know what was going on with Jey. He looked gassed. He looked lethargic. He got a little bit better as the match progressed, but this is the main event, dude. Like, you are crowning a new World Heavyweight Champion. Where's the urgency? I felt like I was watching half this match in slow motion. And Jey has talked about this before, how he's used to tagging in and out of matches with his brother, but singles matches, right? That's a different beast altogether. And how he gets blown up after his entrances. He talked about this on the Unreal series on Netflix. I think it was the second episode. He gets blown up doing all the yeeting. Some people get blown up from eating. Jey gets blown up from yeeting. And, you know, he was on the post-Raw show that they do, the post-Raw podcast on Monday with, I think, Sam Roberts and Megan Morant. And Jey was on there talking about being frustrated with people saying, I'm just an entrance. He did nothing in this match to shut those people up. And do you know how many people on that roster would kill to be in the position that he's in right now? Like, you got to step it up, dude. So Bron Breakker will have his time. Now is not that time. WWE, they have their idea for what they want that to look like when Bron finally wins the big one. And so even with Seth Rollins getting hurt, they don't intend to deviate from those plans. So now we wait and see, you know, does Punk end up in War Games tagging with Roman Reigns? That seems very likely to me. I'll certainly take that over the MFTs being in War Games. So when this show was over, no surprises at all on this show. It played out exactly the way that I expected it to. Punk wins the belt. Jade wins the belt. Cody keeps the belt. Dom keeps his belt. But because we had two new champions crowned and the John Cena announcement, this ended up being a newsworthy show for those reasons. Also, the first Saturday Night's Main Event of 2026 will be held in Montreal January 24th. SmackDown is going to be held there the night before. So that will make three straight months of Saturday Night's Main Event shows. And just like this year, that one takes place a week before the Royal Rumble.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet, and you and I have something in common. We both love pro wrestling. So when this episode is done, I invite you to check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. We're breaking down everything that happened this past week in wrestling, including Saturday night's main event. And we've had some incredible guests on the show lately. The likes of Shawn Michaels, AJ Styles, Rhea Ripley, Chelsea Green, Seth Rollins, Kurt Angle, Samoa Joe, and Bayley, just to name a few. You can find Insight with Chris Van Vliet on Spotify or Apple or wherever you're listening to this right now. Or just search for Chris Van Vliet on YouTube as well.
AEW held its Fright Night episode of Dynamite on Wednesday, and I enjoyed it a lot more than I have in a while. Right down to the reveal with Hangman Page dressed up as Tony Schiavone at the end of the show. The master of disguise, Hangman Adam Page. Samoa Joe won a four-way match over Bobby Lashley, Ricochet, and Hook to become number one contender for the world championship at Full Gear. No surprise there. I mean, once the ops turned on Hangman, you knew this was headed for a rematch. The match itself was very good, albeit predictable. Hook was in there despite a 16-match win streak to take the loss. Lashley and Ricochet, they canceled each other out as the Hurt Syndicate and the Demand are continuing their beef. And at that point, I was waiting for the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man to show up and reveal himself as Hangman, which is a gag they did before many years ago on one of those Halloween episodes. And throughout the night in the back, we saw the Marshmallow Man and a bunch of other characters in costume, as it turned out, just to throw us off the scent so that when they came to the ring after the main event, Joe had the ops dispose of each one of them. And it wasn't Hangman under the marshmallow head. It was some random dude. Joe then signed the contract for Full Gear. Tony Schiavone was there. He was dressed as the Phantom of the Opera, The same costume he wore at Halloween Havoc 1990. 35 years ago. Kevin Nash worked that show as one half of the Master Blasters. He only debuted in the ring the month before. That's how far back that goes. So he dusted off the Phantom Mask for this one, and they did such a good job with this. I did not even notice that they had done the old switcheroo when Shivani left the ring. He was outside the ring. He was still announcing stuff on the mic. You could hear him. And then he eventually made his way back in, or so we thought, to share in a toast to the new number one contender. A toast to Samoa Joe on his big win. But it wasn't Shivani. It was Hangman disguised as Tony Schiavone. Right down to them playing Tony's voice on the PA system, hyping Full Gear, and having Hangman Schiavone, we'll call him, in the background. So now we could see him, right? We still didn't know that it wasn't actually Tony, but you hear Tony's voice. And so Hangman, under this phantom mask, is mouthing the words, and he's raising the beer bottle up in the air, and he's like miming the words as if he's actually speaking, until the voice finally changes to Hangman's voice. And then he smashed the beer bottle over Joe's head, and then he dropped him with a buckshot lariat. This was very well done. They got me. This may yet become an annual thing now, with Hangman dressing up in some unexpected, ridiculous way. But he did say that he would make Joe's life a living hell after what Joe did to him at WrestleDream. So this was the babyface delivering on that promise with a fun angle to close the show. The Callis family, they had a summit that saw Don Callis leading his bloated family down to the ring for the unveiling of his latest painting. Takeshita was said to have had travel issues. He was not there. Andrade obviously wasn't there. He was there in spirit. And they unveiled the painting, which he is calling La Familia, which had Callis shirtless and jacked with a Familia tattoo across his abdomen, standing in front of the rest of his family members, also shirtless. Of course, Takeshita does eventually show up. He does not look very happy. Okada's in the ring. He looks unimpressed by his arrival. And they come face to face, and Callis has to get in between the two of them. And he tells him, I need you guys, okay? I really need you to put the bad blood aside. Team up together on Collision, but go ahead right now and shake Okada's hand. Which he does, only for Okada to flip him off with the cheesiest smile on his face that you will ever see. I saw someone online call him the ultimate rage baiter. He really is. He really is. You'll note how Don Callis, by the way, was telling Takeshita to put his ego aside and shake Okada's hand, even though Okada is really the one who instigated all of this, and he's the one who's been stoking the fire now for weeks and weeks. Just goes to show you who Callis clearly favors between the two of them and who he's going to be sticking with when this thing finally blows up. I think the stuff with Okada the last few months has been tremendous, and linking him up with Callis was a very good move, but now it is time to elevate Takeshita to that next level, which should be the whole point here, and I assume it is. They've really been taking their time to build this up properly. Yeah, we hear so much and talk so much about the importance not just of in-ring, which AEW, I mean, they've got that down pat, but the importance of story and angles and week-to-week television and coming up with interesting stories. This right here, I'll be honest with you, this story right here, it's a very simple one, but you could see the tension between these two guys. This is the best story going in AEW right now. Like, as far as like the episodic television week to week and the way they've been building this up, this is my favorite thing on any of their shows. And as good as some of the matches were on that show on Wednesday, it was the non-wrestling stuff, right? Like the Hangman angle and the Callis family stuff that really helped carry this show. This is the kind of segment that we need to see AEW do more of. Something that we would not normally see beyond like a match or a video package. Something like that to really help build these feuds and build these matches up. And more character development. Like even the segment from a few weeks ago, right before Takeshita won the IWGP title, where you had the rest of the family, they were celebrating Don Callis' birthday. They're at like this big dinner table. And Takeshita sent in a video message from Japan. And Okada uses the remote to cut off the end of the message. And then he says, oh, I hit the wrong button. I'm so sorry. Like, that was genuinely funny. His comedic timing is just tremendous. But that's the type of stuff that I want to see more of on these shows. You know, they may do out-of-ring stuff sometimes that doesn't hit. Not all of it is great. Not all of it is funny. Same thing with WWE. A lot of it isn't funny, but when they do hit, it's gold. And I hope they do more of it. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. I use ExpressVPN every week, okay? Damn near every day. But imagine for a minute, let's say I was on the train, okay? I'm on the subway. I'm on the D train to Coney Island. And I'm on an important call with my doctor's office. I'm getting some test results. But I've got the call on speakerphone. Why would I want to share my medical results with a bunch of strangers? Or better yet, why would a bunch of strangers care about my test results? I wouldn't want to share that with the world. Well, that's what it's like using the internet with that ExpressVPN. Because all of your traffic flows through their servers, internet service providers, and that includes mobile providers, by the way, they know every single website you visit. And in the U.S., ISPs are legally allowed to sell that information to advertisers. This is why everyone needs a VPN. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your ISP can't see your browsing history, nor should they, because it really isn't any of their business. ExpressVPN is the best VPN because it's super secure. It hides your IP address, making it very tough, very, very tough, for third parties to track your online activity. It's also easy to use. With the tap of a button, you're fully protected. It also works across all of your devices, including your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay private on the go. There's a reason that ExpressVPN is ranked number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. You know, when I'm on the road traveling to shows for House of Glory, like I will in a few weeks when I'm on Long Island and in Chicago after that, I always have at least my tablet, if not my laptop, with me. And I make sure I've got the ExpressVPN app installed and active. That way I've got the peace of mind that I need to know that I've got the same level of protection away from home that I do when I'm in my home. My privacy is too important. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Speaking of Takeshita, he defeated Hirooki Goto this morning, the same Goto playing E. Honda in the new Street Fighter movie, to retain his IWGP championship at the Hiroshi Tanahashi Final Homecoming Show in Tanahashi's birthplace of Gifu. After the match, Takeshita cut a promo wanting to know who his opponent would be at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th. And out walked the IWGP global champion, Yota Tsuji, who beat Tanahashi in the semi-main on the show. He accepted the challenge, and Takeshita demanded that Tsuji put his global title on the line, which he agreed to do. So the main event at Wrestle Kingdom is now official. It will be a double title match between Takeshita and Tsuji. 6 years after Naito beat Okada in the Dome main event in that first double gold dash, we're getting another double gold dash here. And I've been saying it for months. You've heard me say this multiple times here on the podcast. When I've commented on this, I've mentioned specifically Yota Tsuji as one of their young stars they've been pushing. I mean, I say young, and he is young, but I mean, the man is 32 years old, but that's young compared to what their main event scene has looked like. These guys have aged out very badly, and it's time to anoint the next generation of top stars. And Yota Tsuji can be one of those guys, if not the guy. He is exactly the kind of name that should be elevated by beating someone like Takeshita at the Tokyo Dome. And they did not say that it would be a unification match. Doesn't mean it won't end up being one, but as best as I can tell, this is not a unification match. This is just a double title match, which means the winner will be a double champion. Takeshita may be a triple champion if he wins that match, because the week before, AEW has World's End. And I have my money on a final in the Continental Classic between Takeshita and Okada. That's going to be one hell of a schedule, by the way, for Takeshita. If he goes right from the Continental Classic and all those weeks of matches to defending in the main event of the Tokyo Dome 1 week later. But he should not be a triple champion. He should not be a triple champion. He should not be a double champion. We have enough of those as it is. Him beating Yota Tsuji would be a very big mistake. And I know he's under contract. He's got like a triple contract with AEW and New Japan and DDT. So he is under contract with New Japan, but he's not a New Japan guy. He's an AEW guy. That is where he spends most of his time. And to have the AEW guy beating Yota Tsuji on their biggest show of the year would be very counterproductive. This is going to be the most watched Tokyo Dome show in years, okay? Maybe even a couple of decades, because remember, it's airing live on TV Asahi. That legitimately has not happened in more than 20 years. They've got Tanahashi's retirement match. They've got the debut of this guy, Aaron Wolf, who's a big celebrity in Japan over there, big athlete, Olympian. This is his first wrestling match on that show. That's his debut. He's wrestling Evil. It's going to be a big, big show. I cannot think of a better place for them to crown Tsuji as their next top star than right there. It'd be cool if they unified the belts and got rid of the global title altogether and brought back the Intercontinental title. But I'm pretty sure the reason they dumped it in the first place is because WWE filed a trademark on the term Intercontinental Championship, which they did about five years ago, I think. Because I don't even think it was a year later, right? It was 2021. New Japan got rid of the belt and they merged it with the IWGP belt. It's like, even if that trademark didn't really apply overseas to like overseas use, I would imagine that as they wanted to continue expanding into the U.S., and they were running more U.S. events, right? I mean, New Japan probably did not want to deal with the headaches that would be involved in promoting intercontinental title matches here in the U.S. on any of their shows and running afoul of WWE. So that's probably why it went away in the first place. Now, some people may be disappointed that, or surprised, that it is not Takeshita against Okada in the Tokyo Dome. I don't know why you would think they would do it there when you know that AEW wants the match. And they're very likely going to be doing the match a week earlier. Why would New Japan want their sloppy seconds in the main event of their biggest show of the year? Two AEW guys, no less, right? The wrestling for your belt, that would be very dumb. So what it does now is it frees up Okada, who absolutely can be on that Tokyo Dome show. But there's something else going on. Tanahashi is having his final match, and it frees up Okada to wrestle Tanahashi in what is going to be the last chance we will ever have to see these two in the ring together. Tanahashi at that show this morning, he was asked by Ghetto, they had a backstage segment, and he was asked by Ghetto, have you decided on your final opponent yet? And Tanahashi said, I don't pick my opponents, we're going to hold a tournament to decide who that person will be. Oh wait, I'm sorry. That's the wrong retirement match. I'm sorry, that's the other one. No, Tanahashi said that he had not chosen yet. So Ghetto told him, if you need one, I will prepare an opponent for you. Now, who has a past with Ghetto? I wonder. Who has a past with Tanahashi? Okada. Tanahashi's next match is on November 8th. He's going to be in Anjo. You know who was born in Anjo? Okada. Do you know whose birthday it is on November 8th? Okada. That would be the perfect place to announce it. I think we're getting one last match between Tanahashi and Okada, his greatest rival. It is the rivalry that defined an entire generation of New Japan Pro Wrestling. It is the rivalry that put New Japan back on the map after some very dark days. Those are the two men who built that company into what it became before COVID hit. Tanahashi against Okada, that is the way. Also on Dynamite, FTR, they won a four-way number one contenders match over the Young Bucks and Jet Speed and Jurassic Express. So they get to challenge Brodito for the tag team titles at Full Gear. That goes one of two ways. Either FTR win the belts and they go on to defend them against Adam Copeland and Christian Cage, or Copeland returns on that show at Full Gear and costs them the belts. I think Tony Khan wants those titles on FTR so that they can eventually drop them to Cope and Christian. Now, on Collision, they aired a segment that was filmed backstage after Dynamite, where Don Callis interrupted a Young Bucks interview with Renee. After their loss, right, they were down in the dumps, and Renee was asking them what's next for the Young Bucks. So in walks Don Callis, and he says, I just met with Tony Khan, and I was able to negotiate the first ever $1 million match. Oh my God, they're escalating these prize money matches. They're into seven figures now. Tony Khan has nothing better to waste his money on. Isn't there a Sir Mix-a-Lot song he can buy the rights to? Callis asked the Bucks to team with Josh Alexander to take on Jurassic Express and Kenny Omega at Full Gear. And he said he would make them rich once more. Yeah, the last time they gambled away $500,000 at the casino, or at least Nick Jackson did. You know, look, that it sounds like a perfectly fine trios match, but are we really not somewhat disappointed in Kenny Omega's match at Full Gear being this random trios match? This feels like a match that you would do in the main event of Dynamite. This is the Kenny Omega match for Full Gear. Is he physically that bad off that he just doesn't trust himself to go in there right now and have a quality singles match? Is that what's going on here? This feels like a Dynamite match. Jon Moxley had a rematch with Kyle O'Reilly after getting himself intentionally disqualified the week before in their first match. And the story with Moxley is that he panics when he is trapped in a submission hold because he doesn't want to quit again the way he did with Darby at WrestleDream. So last week he hit the referee. This week he ended up outside the ring. He was trapped in a guillotine. That led to a lame double countout finish. All hell broke loose after the Death Riders were out. Then the other members of the conglomeration were out. And we got the official challenge issued by Darby Allin and the conglomeration to a blood and guts match with the Death Riders next month. Two blood and guts matches 2 weeks before we get two War Games matches at Survivor Series. You talk about running a match type into the ground. But that'll hopefully be where Moxley surrenders and the implosion of the Death Riders can begin, because the biggest disappointment coming out of WrestleDream was the continuation of so many different feuds, as if WrestleDream was a dream. And it never even happened. Darby and the Death Riders especially. Blood and Guts is the place to end it. And speaking of Blood and Guts, we now have the confirmed lineup with names for the men's match. This was announced on Collision last night. Representing the conglomeration, it will be Orange Cassidy, Kyle O'Reilly, and Mark Briscoe. Roderick Strong, who I guess the gimmick with him is he doesn't really want to be part of this group, but he kind of is, I guess. So Cassidy, O'Reilly, Briscoe, Strong, and Darby Allin are going to be taking on Jon Moxley, Claudio Castagnoli, Wheeler Yuta, Daniel Garcia, and Pac. That is your men's blood and guts match. Now, over to the women. The women's tag team titles, they will be decided soon. We still don't know where and when. I would assume Full Gear. They opened the tournament this week with what I would consider an upset, with Julia Hart and Sky Blue beating Jamie Hayter and Queen Aminata. That busted my bracket because I had Hayter and Aminata moving on to the finals. They will now take on the winners of the match coming up this Wednesday, with Mercedes Moné and Athena taking on Willow Nightingale and Harley Cameron. Penelope Ford, who was going to team with Megan Bain, is out of the tournament. She has a torn UCL, which is a ligament in your elbow. It's the injury baseball players, pitchers especially, they get Tommy John surgery for. In her case, the recovery depends on how bad the tear is and if she's going to need surgery. It could be a few months, could be a lot longer than that, but she is out indefinitely. And so Marina Shafir has stepped into her place to team with Megan Bain. So they are going to be wrestling Anna Jay and Ty Mello in the opening round, with the winners of that match wrestling the winners of the match with Toni Storm and Mina Shirakawa against Alex Windsor and Riho. Hayter and Aminata getting bounced out of the opening round has me wondering if Mercedes and Athena even make it out of their match on Wednesday, let alone go to the finals. I don't have them winning, but I at least had them advancing in the tournament. Now I'm not so sure. I still have Tony and Mina winning the belts, either way. But here is the lineup now for the women's Blood and Guts match. On the heel side, it will be Mercedes Moné in her first Blood and Guts match, Megan Bain, Marina Shafir, Tekla, Julia Hart, and Sky Blue. They're going to be taking on Chris Statlander, Toni Storm, Harley Cameron, Jamie Hayter, Queen Aminata, and Willow Nightingale. So unlike the men's match and all the other previous Blood and Guts matches, this is 6-on-6. So there's 12 women in this, and then there's 10 men in the men's match. All but two women in Blood and Guts are involved in that tag team title tournament. Mercedes and Statlander, they're on opposing sides, which makes sense given that they're wrestling for the world title at Full Gear. So everything ties together nicely for this match, and it makes sense. So many of these women have been feuding now for months, right? Mostly on Collision, but they have been feuding for quite some time, and it feels like, okay, if you're going to blow this off, this is how you do it. You know, you do it in a blood and guts match. That's how it should be done. If you're gonna do a match like that, then at least, you know, it should be used as sort of a battleground to blow off some longstanding issues that, you know, some wrestlers have been having. Other news and notes, the class action lawsuit brought against Logan Paul over his alleged crypto scam, which got tossed out by a judge in August, was reaffirmed by another judge this week, officially putting it to rest. TMZ had the story. The case stemmed from CryptoZoo, which was a 2021 NFT game that Logan co-founded that promised players could earn money by breeding virtual animals. The eggs that players purchased would then be hatched into random animals that would proceed to breed new cartoon eggs that would hatch and so on. Did anyone else see the Black Mirror episode from the most recent season called Plaything? This is giving me Plaything vibes. If you know, you know. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's kind of similar. Anyway, the project never really got off the ground. Disgruntled investors filed a class action lawsuit last year claiming Logan and his team rug-pulled the project and misled buyers. According to a magistrate judge, the plaintiffs failed to link Logan directly to their alleged losses. This week, a district judge agreed. Logan's attorney, Jeff Neiman, tells TMZ, "The district judge reaffirmed that ruling, holding once again that no reasonable juror could find Logan's statements misleading or fraudulent. With the case now dead, Logan walks away without any sort of penalty, while CryptoZoo investors are left with nothing but broken promises and unusable NFTs." Well, if you're going to buy NFTs from Logan Paul, that's the risk you run. You know, last year he did announce that he was establishing a buyback program to repay the people who lost their money. I don't know if those people were ever made whole or not. I hope they were. But importantly, one of the requirements of said buyback program was that they would waive all rights to sue him over CryptoZoo, which sounds more like a settlement to me to avoid having to pay a lot more in damages that he was being sued for. And then there's Vince Russo, bro. A name that I did not think I would ever hear about again as far as working for a wrestling promotion. He doesn't even like wrestling anymore. He's talked about only watching it and reviewing it on his shows as a way to make money and nothing more. He's also offered his consulting services over the years to WWE and AEW. Consulting. You know full well if they offered him a writing gig, he'd have taken that in a heartbeat. But no one was banging down his door offering him one, and they're still not. So instead, he went out and bought his way into one. He is now an investor in Juggalo Championship Wrestling, which has a history that dates back to 1999. It was founded by the Insane Clown Posse, Shaggy 2 Dope, and Violent J. There were rumors that the NWA had brought Russo in to book their shows, and Russo ran with it. But it was pretty clear. You know, I listened to the actual clip. I don't even know what show it was. It was him and a co-host, and it was brought up, "Oh, Vince, I hear you're writing now for the NWA. And just, you know, he kind of went on with it. It was pretty clear that he was being facetious. Dave Meltzer initially reported it as fact, but he is not affiliated with the NWA. Not only is he invested in Juggalo Championship Wrestling, he appeared on camera on at least one of their upcoming episodes. JCW, they issued a press release on Russo's involvement with the company on Monday morning, saying, "Known for his controversial and era-defining work in WWE, WCW, and TNA, Russo appeared during the taping in a segment that immediately has the wrestling world buzzing. His involvement marks a new chapter for JCW, which has been gaining momentum with its weekly Lunacy series, which airs new episodes every Thursday on YouTube." The wrestling world is buzzing. And here I thought that was just the fly buzzing around my ear because I left the window open. Lunacy is their flagship show. It's also a great word to describe Vince Russo being involved in a wrestling promotion in 2025. I'm not even saying that wrestling is exciting right now, because really it's not. And maybe Russo fits in perfectly with whatever the Juggalos are doing over there. But listen to what he's got in the can already, since he's already written 9 episodes of television. Okay, I'm wondering who, beyond the diehard JCW fans, this is actually going to appeal to. Now, I don't know if he was being serious about all of this or not, but Russo says in the first shows that he wrote, someone gets concussed, that's in storyline, I assume, and they talk about concussion protocol. They drug test, again, in storyline. Not only do they drug test, but the guy responsible for taking the drug test literally stands next to the stall of the wrestler to make sure that they are not using someone else's piss. And a female wrestler that is in danger of losing power pulls the Me Too card. This is all in the first 9 episodes. Now, I went on their channel to check out a recent episode from a few months ago. That was the most recent one that I could find. And I'm scanning through it, and I spot someone who looks an awful lot like Brian Zane. My friend Brian Zane of Wrestling with Regret coming out to the old Joy of Painting theme song. I fucking love Bob Ross, so I immediately recognized the music. And of course, he was coming out with like a painting, and it was clear, you know, it was a playoff of that. But I'm watching this, and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm watching here. But the episode with Russo on it is slated to drop on Thanksgiving Day. It might actually be more entertaining than Collision that night. This is just, I hate to say it, but this is just begging for me to review it. This could be the greatest, worst thing of all time. One thing I will say from the one episode that I was skimming through is that they rely heavily on characters. And I mean characters, like as wild and wacky as you would expect. I think that's something that is lost in wrestling right now. Like, there aren't enough real characters. You've got some, but those, you know, colorful characters are what made me a wrestling fan, right? That's not a bad thing. It can be. It's having bad characters where it becomes an issue. But that is something I think that is sort of a lost art in wrestling, and I wish we had more of. All right, it's mailbag time. You could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Carlos from New York, take it away. He says, with Candice LeRae recently doing agent work, similar to Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate, stuck in the Grande Americano universe, why does WWE continuously sign people who are highly skilled in-ring performers and then not allow them to show out and be standout members of their divisions? And do you think something will change where in-ring-based people will start looking at WWE differently? I've never heard it put that way before. In-ring-based people? You mean wrestlers? They're all in-ring-based. But I know what you mean. Highly skilled, technical in-ring performers. Look, they know what they're getting themselves into when they sign. And everybody signs with WWE or AEW for different reasons. Sometimes it's the money, and sometimes it's the money is important, but it's not just the money. Sometimes it's because they just think, man, I'm not going to be a good fit for this place, but I think I'll be a better fit over there. That's how I felt about Josh Alexander. I thought Josh Alexander going to AEW made more sense. You know, and then they added him to the many, 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 many members of the Don Callis family. It remains to be seen whether or not that was the right move as far as his career goes, but he made the decision that he felt, you know, business-wise, he needed to make. So a Candice LeRae or a Pete Dunne or a Tyler Bate, I don't know what their aspirations were. I don't know if they aspired to one day do agent work. And if they wanted, maybe they went to Triple H or they went to Nick Khan and said, hey, I want to coach. I want to produce. I want to do this. I want to do that. I want to do more. And if so, maybe they only did it because they're not being utilized right now. I cannot imagine that a Pete Dunne or a Tyler Bate is happy, you know, prior to the stuff they're doing now, maybe even now. But even before they were under the mask doing the Grande Americano stuff, I can't imagine that they were happy sitting on the sidelines. You know, I know Bate was hurt for a while, but he's been okay now for quite some time. And they made a good team. And even if you didn't have them together as a team, like, it's crazy to me that you can't find good spots for some of these people on the roster. I mean, look at Kaiser. Kaiser has made the most of the Grande Americano stuff, you know, since Chad Gable got hurt. And under that mask, he is super over in Mexico. He goes to these AAA shows, and it's like Dom. It's like two totally different people. I mean, they're treated like rock stars down there. So I'm sure he's having the time of his life. But before that, they were doing nothing with him. He was coming to TV and sitting in the back and doing nothing. And you cannot tell me that someone like him is happy and content to sit in the back and watch everybody else get opportunities. Right? But that's a risk you run when you sign with a company like WWE, unless you are this larger-than-life personality and you are someone who comes in with a big name. You don't know where you're going to end up in the pecking order there. And you may well get paid to sit around doing a whole lot of nothing, and I'm sure that's incredibly frustrating. Why does WWE sign these people? They sign these people, even if they don't see them as top stars or main event level performers, they sign them because you need people like that on your roster. You need to have people who are competent in the ring who could go out there and have great matches with other people who are probably the ones getting pushed. They need Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate or Candice LeRae if you're in the women's division. You need people like that to work with. That's why they sign them, even if they have no intent on really pushing them seriously. They're the workhorses of the roster. Doesn't make it right, but you want to know why, that's why. Alex from Milwaukee. With the vision being about Paul Heyman wanting Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed to be patient, and all the talk about a third member being added, it got me thinking how things could play out in the coming weeks. Bron Breakker will start to lose patience with Paul Heyman making these promises while not being able to get the vision where they want to be because of Adam Pearce. This would lead to Breakker adding a new member with Tony D'Angelo getting called up, with the reason being that he will be the fixer for the vision by getting things done faster than Heyman's politicking. With his gimmick being an Italian mob boss of sorts, Tony would be the guy to get dirt on Adam Pearce that could then be used to blackmail him. Oh, this is getting dark. Into giving the vision what they want. This, in turn, would lead to Breakker becoming World Heavyweight Champion and eventually getting Heyman ousted from the vision. When he eventually returns to get revenge, Heyman would send Brock Lesnar after them, leading to Bron Breakker against Brock Lesnar. Do you think this would be a good way to call up Tony D'Angelo? You know, I have stated before that I am not a fan of Tony D'Angelo being called up with this gimmick. I think it works fine in NXT. I think if you call him up, unless there are serious tweaks and changes made to this character, I just think this is a road to nowhere. Adding Tony D'Angelo, the Italian mob boss wannabe, to the vision makes the vision look like a complete joke. I think that would be a terrible idea. Now, if Tony D'Angelo wants to get a makeover and they want him to, you know, be called up to the main roster with a completely different gimmick, then maybe it could work. Him as the fixer and him being, you know, the mob boss guy who comes out there doing the accent and doing the mannerisms and everything. I cannot envision that, no pun intended. I cannot envision them putting him in the vision, which is supposed to be the top heel faction on this show and taken seriously. I'm sorry. It's just hard for me to take that character seriously in that type of spot. I don't see it. Now, a Bron Breakker Brock Lesnar match down the road next year or in 2027. Sure, that's not the way to get there. That Tony D'Angelo character should not be inserted into the vision. You want to have him in some sort of mid-card faction, that's different. In the vision, though, I would keep him far away. Moli from Toronto, Canada. There has been so many news out there at the time with Triple H sitting in production meetings and having so much input in the storylines and match finishes. I think he's talking about years ago. The Montreal Screwjob and Davey Boy losing the European title to Shawn Michaels, even though he originally wasn't supposed to. Triple H was very close with Shawn and he knew how much Vince loved him. Do you think Triple H would have the balls to do any of those things if it wasn't for his friendship with Shawn Michaels? Do you think Triple H would always have been lined up to work in some sort of backstage role with or without Stephanie? All right, so that's two completely different questions. Triple H having a voice behind the scenes and speaking up absolutely had everything to do with his friendship with Shawn Michaels. Would he have had the guts to stand up and say some of the things he probably said? I'm going to say no. That's different from asking, would he have been lined up to eventually work in a behind-the-scenes capacity had he not married Stephanie McMahon? I'm going to say yes. That would have happened. I'm not saying he would be the chief content officer and running the show and being in the Vince spot. I honestly don't think that happens, were it not for his marriage with Stephanie. But you got to remember, Triple H was being invited into production meetings as far back as 1997. Long before he had any sort of relationship on screen or off with Vince's daughter. Because Vince saw something in him that he took an interest in it, and he allowed him into those meetings. So that was already happening before he met Stephanie. So I don't have any doubt that he would be involved, you know, behind the scenes in some capacity. But do I think he would be in the spot he's in right now? No, I don't. I don't know who would be. It's a really good question. Probably Bruce. I don't know. Jacob from McAllen, Texas. I have a question that has been irking me for a while. I always hear about the Dudleys and the Hardys and Edge and Christian, but what about Too Cool? Are they Hall of Fame worthy? In my opinion, Brian Christopher and Scott Taylor contributed to the Attitude Era, as did their fellow teams. Is Too Cool Hall of Fame worthy? Are they WWE Hall of Fame worthy? Yes. I would put them in as a trio with Rikishi. Even though Rikishi already went in 2015, but they've put multiple people in multiple times. So, I mean, when does that stop them? Too Cool was already over before Rikishi joined the act, but Rikishi does not get over without Too Cool. I don't know if that's a hot take, but that's my take. Rikishi does not get over the way that he did without Too Cool, without that pairing. And I know Scotty Too Hotty was hot about Rikishi not mentioning them in his Hall of Fame speech. He felt very hurt by that. I did think that was kind of weird that he wouldn't mention them. It's like Undertaker not mentioning Mick Foley in his Hall of Fame speech. I just chalked that one up to an oversight. With Rikishi, I don't know what was going on in his head that he wouldn't have mentioned these two. But they were super over during that era, so sure, I would put them in. That's by the standards of what the WWE Hall of Fame is. If we were to judge this as more of a legitimate Hall of Fame, they would not even be allowed in the door without paying for a ticket. Okay, I'm sorry. That's the truth, and you know I'm right. Nick from the Bronx, longtime listener from the TV Tracks days. I was watching WWE's Vault YouTube channel this past weekend, and the WWE Wall Street event was uploaded. I noticed that there was a logo for WWF Racing. I don't remember WWF Racing. Did WWE? That's what it feels like lately. It's WWE. I'm going to start calling them that. Did WWE have a pro racing team that they sponsored? If so, was it similar to WCW having a monster truck team? Yes. Yeah, so what it was in the Attitude Era. They started sponsoring a drag racing team. I think they were funny cars, and the cars were decked out in various logos for WWF and also some of their bigger names like Stone Cold and The Rock. I think The Rock had his own funny car. Yeah, they were expanding into a lot of things back then, which is how, you know, they ended up with the restaurant in Times Square. By the way, if you didn't see that, that is a hidden gem that they uploaded to that Vault channel. I think it was last week. They had an event literally outside on Wall Street. They set up a ring, and they had a whole bunch of matches, and this was in, had to be the year 2000. I think it was about a year after they went public, but they were switching from, was it NASDAQ to the New York Stock Exchange or the other way around? I forget which, but there was some kind of change that was made, and so they had a big event to promote it. So that's the event that he's referring to. Molly snuck another question in here from Toronto. What are some of the memorable short title reigns or title changes for you? For example, when Jeff Hardy beat Triple H in 2001 on SmackDown to win the Intercontinental title, he lost it the following episode on Raw. You know, for me, it's Mankind beating The Rock to win the WWF title on Raw with the assist from Stone Cold. One of the most memorable title changes of all time, still to this day, the loudest pop, at least I wasn't in the building, but watching it on television and the camera shaking and people losing their minds, the biggest pop of all time. And his reign only lasted, 3 weeks? You know, Foley once called himself the Bret Hart of transitional champions. I love that. Now, you're supposed to transition the title from one person to another, and his first two titles went right back to The Rock, so it's not entirely accurate to call it, you know, a transitional run each time, but at no point were any of his three title reigns intended to push him as the top guy in the company. It was all done with the intent of getting the belt off of him as quickly as possible and onto the person that they actually wanted that belt on. What other ones? Andre beating Hogan live on NBC to win the world title, right? And then immediately surrendering the belt to Ted DiBiase. Doesn't get any shorter than that. That one's pretty high up on the list. Fucking 30 million people watch that one. Undertaker, of course. This is a year after he debuted. Undertaker at Survivor Series beating Hulk Hogan to win the championship.
Oh, you got me, brother.
And then he lost it like a week later. Tuesday in Texas. Roddy Piper. He won the Intercontinental title at the Royal Rumble. That was very memorable. He had not won any championships in that company up to that point. And he didn't hold it for very long. He dropped it. It was a few months later, but he dropped it to Bret at WrestleMania. Kane, of course, his one-day title reign in 98. That one right there, that is top three of the most memorable short title reigns of all time. You got to include that. And I was just thinking about, like, man, the summer of 98. That summer was something else. I can remember the feeling of that summer. Man, the summer of 98 in wrestling, if you made a Mount Rushmore of wrestling summers, that one would be front and center. The summer of 98. Chris Jericho is another one beating Triple H on Raw for the WWF title in 2000 and then having it taken away from him in the very next segment. That title change was fantastic. It blew the roof off the place. Jericho hadn't even been there a full year yet. You know, I think there is something to be said for short title runs. I'm not talking about playing hot potato every week with the belts, but I do miss short title runs. There's just too much emphasis these days placed on the number of days that someone is champion for. Like, they have become obsessed with records.
So-and-so has been the champion for 1,000 days. She's the forever champion. This person's been champion for 500 days. The Judgment Day. They've been tag team champions for 430 days with two title defenses. Like, it's fucking boring. Like, one or two dominant people with long runs, fine. But my God, why does everyone need to have long title runs these days? Is the competition for these belts in these companies that bad that they have this many people going hundreds and hundreds of days as champion? We got Chase Pack from Braintree, Massachusetts. You mentioned Mantar on the streams a couple of times this week. For your newer fans, can you clear up for them exactly what makes up a Mantar, fraction-wise? You usually say it, but you did not this week. Well, of course, that would be half man, half tar. Half and half. Hope that helps. Tommy from Georgia. Buy two, rent two, sell two. Blade Runner Sting, Surfer Sting, Crow Sting, Joker Sting, Vato Sting, Grandpa Sting. Well, that is a very intra-Sting question. Sorry, I had to. I had to. I saw my opening. I had to take it. So I got to buy two, rent two, and sell two. I mean, see, this one to me, though, is easy, though. You got to buy on Surfer Sting and Crow Sting. Like, that's it. You got to buy on those two. Those are still the two best versions of Sting. I'm going to rent Joker Sting. I know some people hated it. I was a fan of Joker Sting in TNA. And I'm going to rent on Vato Sting. Because that's a guy you don't want to fuck with. And then I'm going to sell on Blade Runner Sting and Grandpa Sting. Grandpa Sting is cool. But, I mean, let's be honest here. Grandpa Sting, you know, at this stage of the game, he's not going to be able to do what Surfer Sting did or Crow Sting did. So I got to sell on him. Rehan from Hanover, Germany. This November marks the 20th anniversary of the SmackDown vs. Raw feud, which led into Survivor Series 2005. What are your thoughts on this feud? What would you have booked different about it, and which wrestlers would you have changed in those respective teams? I don't really have much in the way of thoughts on this. I just remember it started with the two general managers, Eric Bischoff and Teddy Long, kind of needling one another. And then, you know, eventually they agreed to field a team, one team each, for Survivor Series. So we got Team Raw against Team SmackDown. I know Eddie Guerrero was supposed to be on the SmackDown team, but then he died like 2 weeks before the show. And they replaced him, I want to say, with Randy Orton. I know they had Carlito and Chris Masters on Team Raw. I would have swiped them out for some bigger names. I think their team was weaker with them on it. Swiped them out with who, though? I don't know. I don't remember the entire makeup of the Raw roster at the time. I know Edge was on Raw. I would have had him on Team Raw. I don't know why he wasn't. Maybe he was hurt. Couldn't have been too bad because, what was it, like a couple months later, he cashed in Money in the Bank? But I don't know, maybe he was hurt. I don't remember him being on that show at all. But that's about all I can offer on that. I know John Cena and Kurt Angle had their own match, so they couldn't be on either one of those teams. Jim from Pennsylvania. I heard you mention the Dusty Rhodes Hard Times promo on the podcast a few weeks ago, and it got me thinking, what are some of your favorite babyface promos in wrestling history? It seems like the majority of the most memorable ones are either by heels or worked shoots that get people talking. Babyface promos don't get nearly as much attention. My personal two favorites would have to be Dusty's Hard Times, which still holds up to this day, and Eddie Guerrero's promo on Brock Lesnar before No Way Out. Well, you're right about one thing. The greatest promos in wrestling history and the ones that get talked about the most are primarily made up of heel segments, or pipe bombs, right, to use that word. Dusty's Hard Times promo is actually pretty routine stuff from Dusty at that time, but it just resonated in a way that other promos didn't. So it's kind of stood the test of time. Eddie's promo, the Addict one that you're referring to, that's way up there too. That's a really good one. I'm going to add in the Mankind promo before the Royal Rumble in 2000, where he transformed into Cactus Jack. Like, the look on Triple H's face was priceless. So that was a great one. And I will throw in Daniel Bryan's retirement speech in WWE, where he talked about gratitude, right? That was about as heartfelt as it gets. Because all of my favorites are heel promos, right? I once ranked Jim Ross's sit-down with Mankind. Remember that three-part sit-down he did with him? I ranked that as the greatest promo in WWE history. I did a whole countdown. I stand by that. But I don't think of that so much as a babyface promo, right? It was a coming out promo for him in a lot of ways. But then he ended it by putting Jim Ross in the mandible claw. So I can't call it a babyface promo. Green from Morocco. Buy, sell, and rent on these dog shit pay-per-view finishes. Sting versus Hogan, Starrcade 97. Triple H against Booker T, WrestleMania 19. And The Fiend against Seth Rollins, Hell in a Cell 2019. And also, would you have gone to WrestleMania next year had it stayed in New Orleans? Yes. There were discussions about Airbnbs being booked already until WWE switched back to Vegas. So I will not be there. If it was in New Orleans, I would have gone. Now, the last WWE show I went to, I think of any kind, was WrestleMania 35. On the finishes, I mean, what am I buying on? Like, the least shitty of the bunch? Or am I buying on the worst of the bunch? I'll buy on the worst. How about we'll do it that way. Seth Rollins and The Fiend. Hell in a Cell. Never, never ever should a Hell in a Cell match end the way that that one ended. Nor should it be contested in the fucking dark, by the way. Okay, so I'm buying on that. I'm going to rent on Triple H against Booker T. And I'm going to sell on Sting and Hogan at Starrcade. So that makes it the least shitty of the bunch. Just because we still got the Sting win in the end. Like, had Hogan just won the match and that was it, like, he retains the title after all that build, it would be the worst finish in the history of wrestling. But as bad as that was, at least Sting won. Like, just looking at these other ones and who actually went over, it's like fucking awful. Just terrible. Aaron from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Last week, you listed off a bunch of ridiculous wrestling tropes. But out of all of them, which one is your favorite? My favorite, probably the ref bump. We just saw one last night. Just the ref bump where the wrestler barely touches them, but they sell it like they've been shot. You know, when they're down for like 15 minutes. It's just so ridiculous, but like, that's wrestling. That's wrestling. Mike from Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania. That's a new one. With Maxine Dupri's count-out win over Becky Lynch seeming to get a good reaction from fans, typically a count-out finish doesn't go over well, but it fit the story in this case. What are some of the best undesirable or fuck finishes ever? One of my favorites is when Finlay debuted on SmackDown in 2006 and he got disqualified for kicking too much ass. As for a match that ends in a draw, I would say Mark Briscoe against Jay Briscoe at Ring of Honor's 50-year festival, where both wrestlers beat the brakes off each other until neither one could get to their feet by the count of 10. You want to talk about great count-out wins. It doesn't get any better than Jon Moxley getting Yano'd in the G1. What was that, like 6 years ago? 7 years ago? That was a huge upset. Moxley's very first loss ever in New Japan, because he was on a roll, and it came at the hands of Toru Yano. Other men had felt the pain of losing to Yano, but on this night, it was Jon Moxley who learned what that pain truly felt like, and thus a meme was born. So that's a great one. What else? This one here, this was not technically a DQ finish, since it was an Iron Man match. But if you remember, the last fall in The Rock Triple H Iron Man match at Judgment Day in 2000, it's right there at the top for me. Shawn Michaels is the referee, he's knocked out, and the McMahon-Helmsley faction, they're kicking the crap out of The Rock. Undertaker debuts, he rides down to the ring, he debuts as the American Badass, and he wipes them all out, only for Michaels to wake up in time to see Undertaker chokeslamming Triple H, which means that Rock is disqualified, and Triple H wins the title. I think it ended up being like 6 falls to 5. It was an all-timer of a finish, and it was an all-timer of a crowd reaction. I mean, I love that match. But technically, the deciding fall in that match was a disqualification. Kurt Angle, Stone Cold Steve Austin, SummerSlam 2001. Austin was throwing everything at this guy, and it wasn't working. So what did he do? He started cheating, and he started beating up referees and stunning referees, and ultimately, got himself disqualified. So I'm sure in the moment, like as I recall watching that show, it was a very frustrating finish. But for the story they were trying to tell there, it was actually quite great. Shawn Michaels against Triple H on Raw for the World Heavyweight title in 2003. It was one of those finishes where, both men's shoulders are down, but you don't know it at first. And he super kicks Triple H. He lands on top of him. And everybody in the building in San Antonio thought that Shawn pinned him. They play his music. It's great reaction. And Eric Bischoff, who had run in to, I think there was a ref bump, and then Bischoff, who was the GM, he ran out, counted the winning fall. But Bischoff just goes right past Michaels with the belt and gives it right back to Triple H. And it's like, well, take a look at the replay. And sure enough, like his shoulders were down. So I get a frustrating finish, but like they pulled it off great. That one stands out to me. John Cena, Randy Orton, No Way Out, 2008. We were talking about this a few months ago because I was wondering if they were going to do a variation of the same finish in their match at Backlash. But they had a match for the championship. I don't remember it being anything special. And Randy Orton, no matter what he does, he cannot put away John Cena. And Cena's squaring up, and Orton's down like on his knees. And Mike Chioda's the referee, and he's just like, he's standing kind of in between them. His hands are on his knees and he's looking at Orton. He's looking at Cena. But he's kind of close to Orton. So you can kind of tell something's about to happen. And Orton just smacks him right in the face. Doesn't knock him out. But Kyoto's like, what the fuck? And he disqualifies him. And when he calls for the bell, the crowd pops. Because, how can you not? It's genius. And he got a big smirk on his face because he knew he just retained his championship. He lost the match, but who fucking cares? He got to keep his belt. That's the kind of finish you could only get away with once every now and then. Like, you can't abuse a finish like that, but, you know, looking at it, like, it was very clever, you know, the way they did that. I also think of another Randy Orton match when he wrestled Christian, defended the World Heavyweight Championship against Christian at Money in the Bank in 2011. And the title could change hands in that match on a disqualification, so he spat, hawked a big loogie right in Orton's face, and Orton just snapped. And ended up kicking him, he punt kicked him in the dick. And he got himself disqualified and handed the title basically to Christian because that was the stipulation that he could lose the championship by disqualification. And the crowd popped for it, even though Christian was the heel. And you got what otherwise would be a lame DQ finish in a pay-per-view match. They popped for it like you would think he was a babyface in the main event, winning the world championship for the first time. They loved it. So those are some of the ones that stand out to me. I'm sure there are others. You guys can chime in. Maybe you got your own favorites. Good stuff, though. I'm going to tie this thing back up. We will save the questions for next week. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. It's especially useful when you have weeks like this where, honestly, there's just not a lot of hard news. You know, thankfully, we had that Saturday night's main event show and stuff coming out of it to talk about. But there just hasn't been a lot of real news lately. So that makes me dive even deeper into the mailbag. And so bring the questions and I will do my best to answer them. Follow me on X as well, at Solomonster. You can follow me on YouTube, Solomonster Sounds Off. I will be live on Monday night for the Raw post show. Same thing on Wednesday for Dynamite and then Friday for SmackDown. And all the other big events coming up this month, including Survivor Series, which is coming up in a few weeks. So make sure you're subscribed over there. I will be back with you next Sunday. That is going to be episode 937 of the Solomonster Sounds Off as we head into Thanksgiving in a few weeks. And I'm very thankful for all of your support this week. So be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great rest of your week, and come on back for 937 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
So you got Moxley on one side, you got Darby on the other. Moxley said, look, I did what I could for Danielson, but this is a war for the future of the sport. And for their credit, you know, they're running what is it with these Shield guys? You know, here on this show, you've got Jon Moxley forming his own faction, coming out every week and talking about the future of the industry, the future of the company, the future of the sport. You got Seth Rollins on the other show, forming his own faction and coming out and basically doing the same thing. I'm fighting for the future, right? Everything is so epic. Like this match that you and I are about to have, Cody, it's a fight for the future of this company. Like, fuck off. What is this nonsense? I don't recall like Stone Cold or The Rock or The Undertaker coming out on television every week, or John Cena or Randy Orton, even if you want to use a different era as an example, coming out on television and cutting these fucking boring promos on television every single week over and over and over again about the same fucking shit. We gotta save the future of the company. How about you worry about yourself? How about worrying about the here and now and not fucking 5 or 10 years from now? What is it with these Shield guys? At least Roman Reigns doesn't give a fuck about the future. He comes out, he just cares about himself. I respect that. Fuck everybody else.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.